This is the RightsCast Network at RightsCast.net.
Former adult film star Robin Weathers has skated by as Pornucopia's do-nothing accountant for years. And who can blame her? Her supervisor has only encouraged her dilly-dallying, and it's given her oodles of time to do what she loves most, coach the talent at her mentor's feminist pornography studio. But then the IRS comes knocking. With her supervisor unable to bail her out, Robin can either come clean and risk her friendships and career, or buck up and find another way to skirt the system. No matter how she chooses, along the way she'll have to confront her blossoming feelings for the man she's enlisted to teach her accounting, and the return of the woman she's always loved, who's finally ready to try to make things work. Accounting for It All by R.R. Campbell. Available November 2018 from 9 Star Press. For more, visit rrcampbellwrites.com/books. That's rrcampbellwrites.com/books. Thanks for listening. Tension. It's more nuanced than constant explosions, giant robot attacks, and characters shouting over one another. So what lies at tension's core, and what tools might we have available to ensure our pages team with it? Hey there, I'm R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 40 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network. In this episode, our guest Tim Storm will take a closer look at tension, boiling it down to three character-reader relationships that writers can use to better understand what it is, why it's important, and how we can best put it to use in our manuscripts. Before we get started, let's take a moment to get to know our guest, Tim Storm. Tim is an award-winning writer and teacher whose work has appeared in a number of journals and anthologies, including Black Warrior Review, Copper Nickel, and Literary Hub. His passion for storytelling and its inner workings informs his teaching, editing, and mentoring, and he has courses and articles on the craft of writing available at stormwritingschool.com. All right, let's get into this discussion of tension with award-winning writer Tim Storm. Stay tuned after the interview for a preview of what you can look forward to next here on the RightsCast Network. Thanks for listening. Well, thank you, Tim, so much for joining me here on episode 40 of the RightsCast on the RightsCast Network.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this topic today. This is actually one I've wanted to cover for quite a while, especially after having seen you speak to this at a conference a couple of years ago. So thanks again for joining me for it. We're talking, of course, about tension, which we want to keep on the page. You know, that's very critical as we're working on our manuscripts. So let's start here. You know, where do you feel tension normally has its source or sources?
Yeah, there's a lot to say about that. And it's definitely, when I'm editing manuscripts, it's one of the main things I'm really looking for is whether there's tension on the page, whether I'm feeling as a reader that constant pull of tension, because I think you can actually do a lot of things wrong with a book, with a story. But as long as you have that tension, that will engage readers, and honestly, it'll still sell books. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, cultural phenomena on books that get a lot of things wrong, but that have the tension, and they're doing the tension really well. So it's a big topic. It's an important topic. I define tension as the anxiety that results from a lack of resolution. And so I think of tension as an emotion within the reader, that the reader is reading along and there's this little anxiety or big anxiety, and it can be varying sizes, but and there's some sort of lack of resolution. And so that's pulling the reader in, because the tension is sort of throwing us off balance. We crave this more stable, consonant state of existence. And so tension destabilizes us. And so we read on in order to, basically it's born from a desire to sort of get back to that stable, balanced state. I think it's also important to note that tension is something we want to exist within the reader. And it's really sort of a grand game of psychological manipulation for writers. We want to make people feel. We're in that sense, we're sort of in the same camp as advertisers or magicians, that we are using these aspects of our craft to get people to feel things. Now, I think we have a more noble purpose than advertising.
I would say so too. I would hope so anyway.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I think writing And storytelling is something that is, rather than manipulating people to buy a product, is getting them to feel, I mean, this sounds sort of high and mighty, but is getting them to feel a connection with humanity. I mean, that's what stories do, is they bond us to a community. They broaden our horizons. So I think there's a much more noble purpose to it. But I do think that the base emotion for the entire endeavor is tension. And so with that in mind, I really like, Robert McKee has this sort of concept, this conceptualization of three different kinds of story audience relationships. And so I think that's useful in unpacking in order to figure out where these sources of tension are coming from. Because writing is about eliciting a reaction within readers, we have to know what are the situations at our disposal in order to elicit those reactions. What are the relationships between the story and the audience? So he talks about mystery, suspense, and dramatic irony.
Yeah, and that's where I'd really like to spend, I think, the bulk of this episode, you know, is really getting into the nitty-gritty with all three of those. So why don't we, you know, kind of walk through a little bit, perhaps some definitions or what each one of those are. So sure. With mystery and suspense in particular, I know it could be really easy. A listener hears that and says, oh, you mean like the genre, right? But of course, we're not talking about those because we're talking about this relationship between the reader and the page to generate this tension. So
let's
maybe kind of, you know, let's tease that out a little bit by starting with mystery. How would you kind of define mystery in this sense? And then is there an example of it in use that you can give us from fiction?
Yeah, mystery. So simple concept here for mystery. It's when the audience knows less than the characters do, or at least less than the main character does. So that's a mystery situation. So you're right. It's not about the genre. And there's sort of other definitions of mystery that float around in the world of writing. But this one is very specific about that kind of audience story relationship. It's when we know less than the characters. And so you find this really all over the place. I mean, off the top of my head, there's a short story called The Husband Stitch by Carmen Maria Machado. There's this mysterious, in the sense of the word, sort of premise to it, which is that the main character has this green ribbon around her neck. She knows, of course, coming into this whole story and throughout the story, she knows what that green ribbon is all about. And you see that other women throughout this story have ribbons tied around them in some form. We don't know. So it's a mystery to us because we know less than the characters do about what these ribbons are, what they signify, what they're hiding, etc. And so that protagonist knows and we don't. And so that puts us into a mystery situation.
And that's certainly a source of tension then, of course, because you're talking about, you know, defining it as this anxiety that results from that lack of resolution or a lack of perhaps, in this case, being in the know, so to speak. And what I really like about that is this idea that you're bringing in from this particular example from Husband Stitch is that it's not anything, you know, that's like this huge, it's not a huge plot point or something like that. It's a really simple symbol that's in world and does just enough to keep readers engaged through that tension to want to know what that's all about.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, a lot of mystery derives from things that are sort of pre-existing in the story world, right? So we don't know about them. You know, another example might be Cormac McCarthy's The Road. And he keeps that mysterious kind of throughout. Like the characters within that, or at least the papa, he knows like why this world was post-apocalyptic. What was the scenario that brought about this apocalyptic situation for him and his boy? And we don't know that. And in fact, we never really learn about it.
Right, yeah.
Because that's not too important to that story. It's a story about this man and his child surviving in this pretty bleak setting. But it remains a mystery to us throughout the whole thing.
I think what's interesting about that as an example, too, is that if we're using that definition, you know, that this tension's coming from a lack of resolution, in The Road in particular, like you say, we never get a resolution. We never get an answer to that source of tension. But at the same time, because the emphasis of the story isn't about what happened to lead these characters here, but what's happening between the two of them. We're not left as readers kind of feeling like we've been cheated or anything, because it's about sort of the proportionate focus on that mystery as opposed to the perhaps suspenseful elements of the story, which I'm sure we'll get to speaking about suspense shortly here.
Yeah. Oftentimes it'll be answered and addressed, those mysteries, and it'll become clearer to us as the story goes on. But yeah, not all mysteries need to be fully revealed.
And then let's, you know, since it's come up here, contrast that a little bit with suspense. And again, we're not talking about suspense as the genre for listeners who are tuning in. We're talking about it in terms of this relationship between the reader and the page. So let's contrast suspense with mystery, and then feel free to throw another example or two at us if you have those ready.
Sure, yeah. Suspense is a situation in which the audience knows as much as the character. So they usually, what the situation is, they don't know what's going to happen, and neither do we. And so we're sort of like co-experiencing their not knowing what's going on. An example of this, I just started reading this book called Children of Blood and Bone, getting a lot of press these days. Mm-hmm. Tomi Adeyemi is the author. And so this one starts, so it's interesting because there's often mystery in the beginning of a story. And this one certainly, there's mysteries about, you know, the character right off the bat knows more about this current situation she's in, which is that she's training in sparring with like a spear, or not a spear, but like a staff. And it's actually this illicit, it's sort of like this underground training. This character named Mama Agba has all these girls in this like textile workshop, and they've set aside everything and they're training to fight. And so it begins with the main character, Zeli, wanting to fight this other girl who's apparently pretty good. But in the midst of that, these guards come in to the village and kind of raid the village. And so they suddenly, you know, all of the girls scramble to get the workstation set up again. And they're all sitting at their workshop workstations with their sewing. And the guards come in and then harass Mama Agba about paying taxes or something like that. So there's a lot of mystery there, just in terms of right off the bat, Zeli knows the whole situation. It's sort of revealed to us slowly over the course of that scene. And then where we really get suspense is when Zeli is she's listening, and the guards are kind of harassing Mama Agba. And then Zeli speaks up and sort of lips off to these guards. We now are in the same place she is in terms of knowing. We know as much as she does, which is to say not much, about what's going to happen as a result of her speaking out against these guards, who are sort of the oppressors of this in this society. So there's, you know, up to that point, she knows more than we do, but there is where suspense really takes over. Another example might be the prologue of Game of Thrones, like the first book,
right,
of the Song of Ice and Fire series, has these guys out in this, I think they're north of the wall in the wilderness, and there's these people they had been watching, this camp they had been spying on, and all these people have vanished, basically. And so they don't know what's happening, and neither do we. So that's just a very clear example of the suspense comes from them not knowing, and then all of these clues that something is horribly wrong and that they should get the heck out of there. But, of course, they don't.
Right, as is tradition in those prologues. And I think
exactly
what I really like about that example in particular is that it shows us that to have this sort of relationship of suspense, we don't need to know the same things as our, you know, characters do, or the characters with which we're relating. It can be the case that we and the characters both don't know something as well.
That's exactly it. Yeah, that's the key to it, is that usually it's a case of us knowing precisely as much as the character, which is to say, not much.
Right, exactly. And I think, too, what I really appreciate about the previous example from Children of Blood and Bone is that we see a relationship here between mystery and suspense, and that one can sort of be used to fuel the other, particularly in the lead up to the earliest events in our story, including the inciting incident. You know, in a first sentence hits us from a manuscript, there's of course going to be a lot of mystery. We don't know much of anything about the character. We don't know much of anything about the world. So we need to find ways as writers, I would say, to take that sense of mystery and sort of lead our readers towards suspense in a way that allows these two phenomena to have a nice interplay with one another and build tension over time throughout the course of the manuscript.
Yeah, that's really well said. Yeah, suspense is definitely the bread and butter of storytelling. It's the main driver of tension. And McKee makes another good point about these. He distinguishes them and says that in mystery, the principal emotion that the reader feels is curiosity. And in suspense, the reader feels both curiosity and concern.
Right. That's good. Yeah, I like that.
A little bit more gravity to suspense because we're now worried about their fate. And so, yeah, so mystery is good in terms of hooking us, but it's really suspense that's really going to be pulling us through the story.
And at the same time, you know, we've talked about two sort of unique scenarios now where we have a situation where characters know more than the reader. We have a situation where readers know as much or as little as the particular characters that are being featured. But that, of course, leaves open this third option, which is one in which we as the readers know things that characters do not. And that might seem a little strange to hear for listeners who are encountering this for the first time. Of course, how could we as the reader know things that characters don't? You know, the characters are our view into the story, but there, as I'm sure we'll discuss in a moment here, there are ways that we as readers can either through inference or through the use of multi-perspective storytelling or through what we know about the real world for stories that are perhaps set in historical or contemporary environments, we can end up in a situation where we know more than the characters do, which is, of course, dramatic irony. So why don't you, if you would, I know I've already kind of broken it down there a little bit, but if you wouldn't mind maybe perhaps elaborating on that, and then if you have any examples that might tease out how it varies from mystery and suspense, I'd appreciate that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good explanation of it. There's various circumstances in which we can get that dramatic irony where the reader knows more than the character does. And probably the first one is when there's a naive character. So the character is childlike or not intelligent or just wasn't present for the information that we have learned. That naive character will then encounter a situation and we know what it's all about. So you can, sometimes that character is naive just by way of sort of their personality. Other times they're naive because they haven't, you know, they're plenty smart, but they haven't been present for the reveals that we know about. And so, yeah, as you sort of hinted at, the structure of a story can create dramatic irony situations. The kind of story, historical fiction, in which we kind of know where the events are going because it's based in that historical fact. When we have parallel plots or multiple points of view, and in a parallel plot, we learn of circumstances that then, you know, cut to the next chapter and we see a character coming into the circumstances that we already know about. And then sometimes, depending on your narration, if you have omniscient narration or retrospective narration, the narrator can just tell us outright, you know, something like, I mean, this always sounds hokey just coming up with it, but, you know, that night when Bob got in his car, he had no idea that he would get into a fatal car accident. You know, something like that, where it's just given away to us, but then the dramatic irony then is arising from watching him go into something that we've already been told will happen. So these are sort of the three circumstances for it. And I can give some examples of a few of those. Like the classic one for dramatic irony is Romeo and Juliet, where we have seen through a parallel plot that Juliet has taken the potion. And so she's not actually dead, but everyone believes she's dead. And then Romeo comes to the tomb. And so, of course, we all know that she's not dead, but he believes she is. So that's sort of a classic instance of getting a naive character through a parallel plot situation that the audience is aware of. And I think of my children all the time with dramatic irony, because just the other week, I discovered a half-eaten energy bar in the upstairs bathroom on the floor. And yeah. And so I knew immediately, like, I have a 6-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old son, and my son is not tall enough to reach into the pantry where these energy bars are. And, you know, no adult in the house, of course, is going to, like, secret this away in the bathroom.
Right.
And on the floor.
Right.
And, you know, so it's obvious to me that she's the one responsible. So you have a dramatic irony situation when it's me asking my daughter, do you know anything about this bar? And then she says, no. That's a classic dramatic irony situation that I encounter on a nearly daily basis these days.
That's funny. And I mean, it's nice to be able to kind of look at real life and, you know, it's sort of that art imitating life, life imitating art kind of thing. All of this exists in our own lives as well. In fact, I was actually in the lead up to this conversation. We're recording this while the World Cup is in full swing, of course. And I realized, you know, as I was watching the game now between Senegal and Colombia about an hour ago, that, wow, the thing that makes sports so fascinating is suspense. You know, we do not know the outcome in the same way that all of these players, or our characters in this case, do not know the outcome. And when you have a moment where one strike the ball could determine the elation or the defeat of an entire country who's cheering for these teams, that, you know, introduces some fun, you know, high-ish stakes. And I think that, again, you know, we can see these examples in real life, whether it's with your daughter or whether it's something with sport where we see suspense, for example. We could have dramatic irony, I suppose, with sports too, if we are watching a replay of a game that we already know how it turned out. But,
right,
you know,
right,
that gets a little bit different at that point. So those are all good examples. And I think that, you know, now that we've kind of laid out what mystery, suspense, and dramatic irony are, maybe let's explore a little bit why it's important to understand these and how we can go about actively stitching each one of them into our own work. Because, of course, the ability to appreciate them from afar is great. You know, we as readers do that all the time when we're reading, whether we've had a name for this phenomenon or not. But it's
right,
also important, you know, as writers, if we can deliberately stitch this into our manuscripts, we're doing our readers a favor, we're doing ourselves a favor, and, you know, we may not be doing our characters a favor because they're going to have all of this unresolved, you know, anxiety around them, but it will definitely make for a more compelling story.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why these concepts, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it seems very academic to say mystery, suspense, dramatic irony, and to argue that writers should know these things, but these concepts, these are the only three story audience relationships. I mean, you can mix and match these a little bit. We can certainly find scenes where all three of these things are at play, but they're the only options available to you. And so it really comes back to the importance of tension and how that's of paramount importance for any storyteller. And these story audience relationships are the ones at your disposal in order to gain that tension. So I guess I would, in terms of like stitching this into our own work, I mean, when you really get into the weeds here, there's a lot of application that you can see in writing when I'm looking at stories and novel manuscripts and short stories, et cetera. I often do comment upon these things. Because I think, I should add too, that McKee, we talked about the distinction between concern, curiosity, and concern. And he adds that in dramatic irony, there's less curiosity and it's almost entirely concern. And so I find that people don't, there are situations where dramatic irony would be perfectly appropriate and you could gain lots of tension from it. And people sort of, with that one especially, because you see it less probably, but with that one especially, I think remembering that it's the tool at your disposal could potentially help you out with some, you know, revision challenges.
Right.
It's interesting because I put together this video course on this and I tried to gather a whole bunch of examples of suspense and I went overboard with this and I broke it down into like, I came up with like 34 different kinds of suspense.
Wow.
But I looked through the Game of Thrones, they're all like video samples. So I looked through Game of Thrones, which I figured there'd be all sorts of dramatic tension or dramatic irony in Game of Thrones because there's all sorts of parallel plots. But there really isn't. He and or these, you know, the screenwriters for that really don't use dramatic irony much. It's mostly suspense, and they really like to surprise the audience. So they rely a lot on surprise. And after like looking over that, I really felt like I almost wanted to go to these guys and say, you could have used dramatic irony in all sorts of situations. And right. It would have been okay. It would have been plenty of tension.
Right. And I think maybe there's a hesitation to do that for folks who are tuning into the show in particular, maybe only because of the presentation of it is such that, you know, you get your hour every week and they have to kind of cut it at that. So they don't want to leave maybe too much dramatic irony hanging. But I do think it's interesting that you picked that out and after your deep dive, you know, didn't find a ton of examples of dramatic irony, because I would have had the same assumption that you did, because I think about something like, and maybe this is me just, you know, conflating timelines now, but I would think that, you know, when Arya is with the Hound and the Hound is trying to deliver her to the twins for Rob's wedding, you know, with the goal of reuniting her and getting his ransom, etc. I have this thought in my head that, like, we already know as they're arriving that we already know the Red Wedding's happened. And I think we might, but there's not a ton of dramatic irony because I don't think it lasts very long. You know, it kind of rolls from the Red Wedding and probably right into an Arya chapter. So though we have it, it's not long lasting. But yeah, now that I think of it, there aren't any other major salient examples of that that stand out, which is really surprising to me.
It is surprising, yeah, because it's a fertile ground for it. And again, like, dramatic irony is not something that I would say is required in every story. Suspense is, and mystery is. But dramatic irony, that's one of the takeaways, I think, is that, you know, I advised someone fairly recently to maybe have a story told out of order where we see this sort of tragic, we don't know how tragic it is, but we see this house fire, which was going to be sort of at the climax of the story. And maybe you reveal that right away, that there is this house fire. And we get some of our engagement and tension through anticipating that that is going to happen. And even knowing when it's coming, and the characters don't know that it's coming. That can be a big driver of reader engagement, actually.
Yeah, I like that idea of, you know, using dramatic irony in a way to kind of start the story. You know, on page one, of course, we won't have recognized it as dramatic irony yet, but by the time that first scene ends, I think we would have settled into that really comfortably. I do think that when I sit down to revise, or even when I'm writing the first draft of a first page, I really try to, and this is something that maybe listeners can try, or something, Tim, that you've done in your own work or tried to help other authors with, is my goal is to create a first sentence that is rife with mystery. And if I can't do it in the first sentence, I want to do it in the first page for sure. You know, I open the first book, or excuse me, I open Accounting for It All, which will be out this November with Nine Star Press. The first line of that isn't especially dramatic, but I do think that there's just enough mystery to nudge someone onward. And the opening line for that one is, Thursdays are my favorite days at Pornucopia. Because, well, what does that mean? Why is that your favorite day? We're getting the readers to ask questions and see if that's something that they're willing to kind of go along with. And we'll contrast that with the opening line of Empathy, Imminent Dawn, which I'll also have out with Nine Star in January of 2019. And the opening line for that one is more dramatic in that it is, Chandra didn't kill her wife, but she may as well have. And that leads us to a ton of questions, you know, like, what actually happened here? Why does she feel this way? What is she going to do to resolve this? And I think if we can use, and my strategy at least, perhaps you'll know of some others, my strategy is to use like a short, simple declarative to kind of like pull readers in a way that communicates, hey, these characters know something, or these characters have something at stake, and we'd really appreciate it if you could get on board with that.
Yeah, I like that. That's very kind. We'd really appreciate it if you could get on board.
Right, I know. Easier said than done, yeah. Of course.
No, I absolutely agree. Like, that's one of the takeaways for the mystery bit, is that mystery is good, and especially for beginnings, not just beginnings of books, but chapters and scenes. And so it's going to be something that will keep coming back throughout the story. But it's advice not to divulge everything. Don't open with a whole bunch of orientation. Just throw us right into it. And if things are mysterious, that's good. That's a source of tension. So it's sort of an argument against one of the many arguments against the exposition heavy beginnings, or exposition just in general, like keep it to a minimum. And I do think most stories begin with mystery and sort of hook you that way. I'm thinking of a short story that I often teach called Anything Helps by Jess Walter. And the first line of that story is, Bit hates going to cardboard. And so it's a lot like the opening line that you're describing, where we're wondering, like, what does that even mean?
Right.
Who is Bit? What does going to cardboard mean? So yeah, don't divulge everything. Mystery is good. Another lesson that kind of comes out of this with regards to suspense is for people to linger on it, to stretch it. When a character is in a situation and where it's a suspense situation, so we know as much as they do or as little as they do, you're going to ally us to them more if you can allow us to feel what they're feeling, to feel their anxiety, to feel their fear, to feel their hope or anticipation. So when you get into those suspenseful situations, like, go close up and slow-mo is kind of what I say for readers. Like, linger on that and stretch it out is definitely one of the takeaways with creating suspense.
Yeah, and I think that the reason that that is so important and also so effective when, like you say, it's stretched out or slowed down and zoomed in is that it creates this really empathic bond between the reader and the character. Yeah. And what are, you know, any of our stories about if not trying to create empathy between readers and situations with which they're perhaps not familiar, you know?
Absolutely. Right.
Well, I think that, you know, we've really hit on, I think, these three main reader-character relationships really well. You know, we've had some really nice examples in here, and we've had an opportunity to take a look at what we might do to stitch this into our manuscripts. But there really is so much more that can be said about all of these. You mentioned having, you know, tons of clips and examples of suspense, for example, and I'm sure you have a ton of mystery and dramatic irony as well. So if you are a listener to this podcast, you know, where can you go to learn more about this? And are there other topics they can learn more about in that place?
Yes. Yeah, so I have a website called stormwritingschool.com, just all one word, Storm Writing School. And so I have a couple classes. So I have three classes up there, and one of them is called the Tension Lab, and that's all about mystery, suspense, and dramatic irony. And that's the one where I talked about going overboard with the examples of suspense, sort of breaking that down further. And I have a couple other courses up there. There's a blog that's associated with that website where there's a ton of other articles. I come out with articles every other week or so. And so lots of craft articles, articles about structure, craft, workshopping attitudes, stuff like that, writing attitude. So those are the main sources where I'm discussing a lot of this stuff. And I've really focused a lot on tension just because of its importance to storytelling. So beginning there and then kind of branching out from there. And then, yeah, I have subscribers to my newsletter, to my email, get a biweekly newsletter, and then notifications on if I make other classes, if I create other classes and put them online, or other, like I have a free ebook on creating tension. So those are available to subscribers.
And I'll say this too, you know, as someone who has attended sessions of yours that you have done at conferences in my local area, and as someone who knows others who have attended sessions of yours, including Kristen Oakley, who has also been a guest here on the Rights Cast, you know, whether it's Kristen or a handful of others, you know, they always have nothing but good things to say about the insight that you bring. And I know they are, you know, once in a while they have those writing retreats and you come and talk about all these topics. I really want to make it to one of those if I can in the next few months here. But listeners, please definitely check out stormwritingschool.com. You know, sign up for that newsletter and you can get a lot more content like this. And it's really, Tim just has a lot of really great resources. So I totally encourage you to check that out.
Yeah, it's just, I have a lot of fun geeking out over this stuff and discussing story theory. And so, yeah, I figured at some point start collecting some of these things and put them down. But yeah, I also really love teaching and love to have a dialogue about it. And that's one of the things you sometimes miss with the online teaching is not enough dialogue. So thanks for having me. It's really fun to bounce these ideas around other people and see what examples they're coming up with.
Yeah, well, I'm really grateful for you to have stopped by the show. We'll have to do it again some other time.
That would be great.
And so concludes this R.R. Campbell WritesCast episode featuring award-winning writer Tim Storm. Thanks to Tim for joining me and to you, dear listeners, for tuning in. I owe the biggest thanks of all to every one of our WritesCast Network patrons at patreon.com/WritesCast, most especially Kristen Oakley, whose financial contributions of $3 per episode go a long way into helping the WritesCast Network become self-sustaining. In exchange for her patronage, Kristen and our other direct financial contributors earn awesome patron rewards, including additional votes in the annual WritesCast Awards, WritesCast stickers, and, at the higher levels of support, partial manuscript critiques and shoutouts in every episode. Every dollar counts, and patrons at every level get something in return for their support, so become a contributing member of our programming at $1, $2, or $3 per episode today by visiting patreon.com/WritesCast. And hey, if a dollar per episode is more than you're able to afford, no worries. You can always cap your monthly contribution at $1 and still get access to the rewards available to other patrons at that tier. To check out the full list of rewards and begin contributing today, you can visit patreon.com/WritesCast. That's patreon.com/WritesCast. The WritesCast Network will return in September for 3 episodes featuring poet and screenwriter Nathan Elias, YA author and MFA graduate Jay Dimitri, and the return of guests Mel Goh and Noelle Nichols, who'll join me for a group conversation about their experiences in the world of self-publishing. Until those episodes debut, you can keep up with all things WritesCast Network by visiting us at WritesCast.net or by following us on Twitter at WritesCast. You can, of course, check out my other writerly content as well by visiting rrcampbellwrites.com or following me on Twitter at @IamRRCampbell. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this is R.R. Campbell signing off. Write on and write well.
This is the WritesCast Network at WritesCast.net.